from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. There is no prior period of change that remotely resembles what humanity is about to experience, writes Al Gore in his new book, The Future, and he's not just talking about climate change. Gore explores the six forces he says will reshape our world in the years to come, and the former vice president, Nobel Peace Prize-winning environmentalist and entrepreneur, will join us in the studio, and we'll talk with him about the book as well as the controversial recent sale of his cable network, Current TV, to Al Jazeera, for which he reportedly earned $100 million. It's coming up next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Former Vice President of the United States Al Gore joins us in studio for this morning's second Forum Hour, elected four times to the United States House of Representatives, twice to the United States Senate. He's the author of Earth in the Balance, An Inconvenient Truth, The Assault on Reason, and Our Choice. And he's also co-founder and chair of Generation Investment Management and presently serves as senior partner at Kleiner Perkins, Caulfield and Byers, as well as being a member of Apple Incorporated's board of directors. 2007, he was co-recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize and recently published another book, The Future, Six Drivers of Global Change. And we welcome Al Gore to the Forum program. Good to see you again.
Thank you. Good to see you again, Michael.
Remember the last time we were together, it was the screening here in San Francisco of Inconvenient Truth with you and Davis Guggenheim. And that was one of the most thunderous applause receptions I have ever witnessed.
Well, Davis did a wonderful job on that movie, and I was privileged to be able to work with him.
And you're being modest because it was very much a part of your doing as well, you and Laurie David and a few others, but you particularly, who brought this to our attention. And now you're probably maybe somewhat tired about getting bashed about Current, because even Matt Lauer went after you on this. There was a sale of Current Television, which was co-owned by Vice President Gore and Joel Hyatt, and it was purchased by Al Jazeera, actually, which is funded by the company of Qatar. I was struck by
the country of Qatar.
I was struck by what you said to Lauer. You said, because there had been a lot of criticism and a lot of bashing, and you said, I understand the criticism, but I disagree with it. So let's talk about what do you understand and what do you disagree with?
Well, I knew before we closed the deal that there would be criticism, and I knew that I would be responding to questions like these, and I'm happy to do so. But in spite of the fact that I knew that there would be criticism and questions, it ultimately was an easy decision and clearly the right decision, because after doing extensive due diligence into what Al Jazeera and particularly Al Jazeera English has become, and Al Jazeera English will be the network from which Al Jazeera America is derived. It really is an outstanding network that does an excellent job. It was Network of the Year last year in England, voted by its peers. In Israel, it has a big following, is on their systems there. One of their systems in Israel kicked off CNN to make room for Al Jazeera English. It's won awards, it's won respect, and perhaps more importantly, it has bet its future as a global news organization on building and maintaining its prodigious reputation for integrity and objectivity. And I think that, you know, as a businessman, I had an obligation to my shareholders, but more important to me is that I had an obligation to do business in a way that would make the country and the world better. And I have no doubt whatsoever that the American media landscape is going to be significantly improved by having a 24/7 news gathering network committed to excellence that covers international news as well as kidnappings and personal interest type stories that the American media is increasingly drawn toward. And I think further that people don't have to take my word for it. They'll be able to see it for themselves.
It's an excellent news operation and has some very good journalists that I know personally. On the other hand, of course, it has been criticized, particularly by the Bush administration, being anti-American, as I'm sure you're aware.
Well, now let me just stop you there, because there may have been some such comments early in the Bush administration. It did not – that was not their – even their attitude when they left. Secretary Clinton said in the current administration, Al Jazeera is part of the solution, not part of the problem. She said they do real news, unlike what our news media do. And I've used the example before of their coverage of the climate crisis. Here in the U.S., if you'll allow this parenthetical, we went through the 2012 election year with more debates than ever in history, at a time when we had the hottest temperatures ever in North America, 61% of the country in drought, huge fires in the West, the worst West Nile virus outbreak ever, Superstorm Sandy, multiple climate-related disasters totaling $110 billion worth of damage, and not a single reporter asked any question to any of the candidates in any of the debates about climate. By contrast, Al Jazeera has extensive and very high-quality penetrating coverage of climate all the time. And there are a lot of other issues where the same contrast can be drawn.
In fact, I think all of what you mentioned kind of got you ticked at Aspen when you delivered that speech about all the climate change deniers and everything. That was the Al Gore a lot of people wanted to see come out of the
Are you talking about the one that had a couple of
expletives? But
I didn't even know that was being broadcast, because they usually have the sessions there, so-called Chatham House rules. And when we got to the end of the session, the moderator said, "You'll be happy to know we're getting lots of tweets already." And I felt like a Doonesbury character with a thought bubble saying, "Tweets? What's going on here?"
I guess, though, getting back to the current sale, a lot of the criticism seemed to be less about Al Jazeera and more about who you are and what you stand for. I mean, Nobel Prize, climate change, global warming, all these things you become identified with as a major advocate. And somehow a country that has made its fortune off of oil and natural gas seemed to be, in many people's minds, the wrong country to be taking, well, you're admittedly, large sum of money from. In other words, I looked in the week right after it happened and said, sellout. And there were people who felt, you sold out.
Yeah, as I told you, I quite understood that there would be people who criticized it on those grounds, but it was the right decision. And in weighing what I knew would be criticism against the clear benefits to all involved, and as I say, not only the shareholders but and the employees, by the way, because any other buyer would have gotten rid of all of them immediately, and they're Al Jazeera is trying to keep as many as possible, and hopefully virtually all. And more importantly, the benefits to the country in promoting more diversity, a better understanding of international news, providing an opportunity for very thorough coverage of issues that don't get covered very well today. It was the right decision.
Let's talk about your book, which, by the way, has praise from our friend E.O. Wilson, from Tim Berners, founder of the World Wide Web, from Arthur Laffer, which I guess to many people might be a surprise, conservative economist. You're really intent in this book on reforming, as I see it, and I've read most of the book, reforming democracy and capitalism. In fact, you begin by saying we got hacked.
Yeah. And as people in your audience know, especially, the word hacked comes from a practice where computer operating systems are taken over from the outside, and the computer's made to do things the owner doesn't want it to do. Our democracy has been hacked, and capitalism has been hacked. In the case of democracy, it's not that complicated. The big money has a much more powerful influence now than ever, more powerful than is healthy for democracy. There are reasons for that, and I go into them in the book. Where capitalism is concerned, this has been less frequently discussed, but I'm an advocate for sustainable capitalism. And what we have now is a plague of short-term decision-making that hurts shareholders, works against the buildup of long-term value. We have increasing use of these exotic derivative products, some of which are indistinguishable from gambling. And the volume of these trades dwarfs the real.
Was Wall Street ever indistinguishable from gambling?
Yeah, I think it has been. Yes, it's always been fraught with complexity, but some of these instruments that are traded in such enormous volumes now are ridiculous. They really don't add anything. People think the advocates or defenders of the practice argue that it increases liquidity in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. But it's really fake liquidity, in the phrase of Joe Stiglitz, who's a great Nobel Prize-winning economist.
He's been on the show a number of times, in fact. And you are sort of debunking that idea of liquidity at the same time that you're talking about just the terrible economic inequality that is generated by the present system. I wonder, though, you're sitting on the Apple board and wondering, Tim Cook, does he deserve a $400 million bonus? I mean,
well,
we're talking about
first of all, that's over 10 years in options that.
But you know why I'm asking. You've got people in the Apple store who are making, working in the Apple store, making a little above Walmart employees as far as hourly wage.
Yeah. Well, I think in the case of Tim Cook, that was clearly the right decision by the board to have a new and steady hand, and after the loss of Steve Jobs, who all of us miss dearly. Tim's doing a terrific job, and we're lucky to have him.
The CEO salaries, though, they're so disproportionate. They're so in excess of many people's minds.
Yeah, and I think that is a problem. Yes, in the case of Tim's salary, I don't think that criticism applies. It's not the salary that has been pointed to there. But around the world, yes, you're seeing a growing inequality, not only with respect to CEO pay, but with respect to the tax system. It's partly a result of this new advanced form of automation that I call robo-sourcing that is hollowing out the middle class. It's partly because the economic measuring stick that we use to tell us whether we're going in the right direction or not has no way of tracking what the distributional effects of economic policies are.
Well, you come after the GDP.
Yeah, it's really an absurd measure. It has its usefulness. It was an advance when it was first created, and all business accounting categories are derived from GDP. But the creator of GDP, Simon Kuznets, when he was honored in 1937 for his achievement, issued a warning. Please, he said, don't use this formula as a guide for economic policy because it doesn't take into account income distribution. It doesn't take into account pollution and other negative externalities, nor depletion of natural resources, nor positive externalities, but by which he meant when we invest in culture and music and art and education, mental health care, community improvement, that's considered an expense. But the enormous benefits that come back from such investments are considered positive externalities that are nowhere calculated. So we cut the things that often do the most good, and we ignore the things like pollution that often do the most harm. And where income inequality is concerned, we are blind to the growing gap between the rich and poor. The U.S. is now more unequal as a society in terms of income and net worth than either Egypt or Tunisia. And that's not good for either democracy or capitalism.
Talking, if you just joined us, with Vice President, former Vice President, well, you always have the title, Al Gore, who is here with us in studio talking about his new book, Future. And It's in the spirit, I think, of Alvin Toffler and others who have written similar kind of books. But early on, you talk about the fraternal twins. I like this phrase of peril and opportunity. Mm-hmm. And you come out as an optimist. You really take a stand here and say you're optimistic. But yet, you know, when I mean, I'm thinking about climate change, particularly when we put it on people like Bill McKibben, probably a friend of yours as he is of mine, and they talk doomsday. I mean, it looks pretty bleak, and you've got the statistics here to make it seem pretty bleak.
Yeah, and my optimism is in spite of what the trends now look like, and my optimism is based on an assumption, excuse me, about human nature, that while we have well-known limitations as human beings, we also have a capacity to rise above those limitations and meet a big challenge when we have to. And I think that with the spread of the internet and the other incredibly powerful new forms of digital communication, we can draw upon those qualities deep within us to use our reasoning capacity, communicate with one another, recognize these six drivers of global change, recognize the challenges they represent, and seize the opportunities while reining in some of the negative trends that they also bring.
Well, you talk about change, and a lot of the book is about change and transformation and progress and the opportunity being on the cusp to move forward. You talk about multiple emerging centers of power, which essentially we've moved from nation states to, or we've moved to private actors as opposed to the political system and to markets. And this is good by your standards, because I'm thinking about, you know, you could mention Al-Qaeda is one of those players now, new players that moved away from the nation state.
Yeah, I think it's both good and bad. It brings those both perils and opportunities. I think that the weakening of our capacity as a people to work collectively through the instrument of self-government is not a good trend. And I think we have to revitalize self-government. And I think that we as Americans in particular have an important challenge in reclaiming control of American democracy from anonymous donors and corporations posing as people and super PACs and the influence of big money, not only for the benefits of our own country, but also because the world needs leadership within the community of nations where the important policy decisions really have to be made. And I don't think there is any—
There's a dearth of it, isn't there?
I mean, yes, there is a dearth of leadership. And I don't think there's any alternative to the United States as the natural leader of the world.
Well, China might disagree.
Yes, but the rest of the world does not, at present at least, and I would argue for the foreseeable future, give China the moral authority to be a leader. China doesn't have free speech at all. They're now seeing an exciting blossoming of comment and speech on microblogs, but it's still censored. And China has levels of corruption that pose a risk to their continued economic rise.
They export things that are not safe. They export things that are toxic. I mean,
yes, that's right.
Helping the American free enterprise system immensely, really.
For those and other reasons, it's unlikely that the world would follow China as its leader. The world has been willing to follow the U.S. because they perceive the U.S. still as the moral leader of the world. But when I travel around the world, I constantly hear friends of the U.S., people who love the U.S., asking, what's gone wrong? What's happening? The U.S. seems to be making a lot of bad decisions. We invaded a country that didn't attack us. We started torturing people. We allowed these subprime mortgages and other risky instruments to blow up the global economy. Where is the kind of sharp, clear, ethically based decision making that the U.S. has been known for in most of the world for most of our history?
Don't you think drones are even a major factor in that diminution of respect and moral authority of the United States?
I don't know that that has been a major factor. It certainly is in Pakistan and
Yemen and Somalia.
And Yemen and the countries where they have been used extensively. I'm not sure that it is the kind of issue globally that the Iraq war was, for example, but it doesn't help, certainly.
You mentioned dearth of leadership. There's also who is in control of the Internet? That remains a looming big question, doesn't it?
Well, you know, when Bill Clinton and I went into the White House in January of 1993, there were 50 sites on the World Wide Web. And the governance of the Internet is something that I and others have spent a long time looking at, and I think it's best served by the kind of leadership and governance that it has that keeps it out of the hands of governments themselves, with the so-called ICANN board that is in charge of it. It will come under increasing challenge, but it's crucially important for the Internet to stay free and unregulated and to be what it is, a self-organizing, a miraculous new way of communicating that is accessible to everyone around the world.
Talking with Al Gore, if you just joined us, and he's a politician, environmentalist, entrepreneur, and author, and his newest book is called The Future, Six Drivers of Global Change. He's with us here in studio. Let me open the phone lines and invite those of you listening if you have questions or comments to make. We certainly welcome your participation, and you can join us now at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. Again, toll-free from wherever or however you're listening to Forum, 866-733-6786. A number of other ways to, well, communicate with us. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. You can also go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, and this optimistic recovering politician is going to spend the hour with us. So if you have questions or comments for him, feel free to join us. We're in an unsustainable growth period, though, and
yes,
to get out of it, you've got some solutions. You've got some ways to ameliorate this. Talk about them.
Well, first of all, we should reexamine the definition of growth that we're using. It is derivative of the GDP formulation that I described a moment ago, and it is driving us in an unsustainable direction.
May I say, it's the first time I've seen the GDP linked to Alfred North Whitehead.
Yes. There are many resources that are crucial to our continued flourishing that are now being put at risk. For example, supplies of fresh water, supplies of topsoil, the web of living species with which we share the planet and whose continued health is absolutely crucial to our own. All of these and others are now being pushed to beyond limits that are wise. Here in this country, for example, the underground water aquifers, like the best known, the Ogallala, is being drained at a very unwise rate, an unsustainable rate. It's almost as if the old cliche, out of sight, out of mind, applies. And in places like China and India, the rate of unsustainable depletion of groundwater is growing even faster. There are critical materials that are also beginning to be at risk. And the growth that we now have is associated with the production of huge amounts of pollution. Every single day, we're spewing 90 million tons of global warming pollution into the atmosphere as if it's an open sewer. And it's trapping so much heat that the cumulative amount now traps enough energy to equal the energy released by 400,000 Hiroshima atomic bombs going off every single day.
I saw that stat in the book, and I was just, floored by it. But then you get into how to move sustainability forward. We're going to come back. We're going to talk more with Al Gore and hear from you. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. There is no prior period of change that remotely resembles what humanity is about to experience, so writes Al Gore in his new book, The Future. And he's not just talking about climate change. He's exploring the six forces he says will reshape our world in years to come. Former Vice President, Nobel Peace Prize-winning environmentalist and entrepreneur is with us in studio, and we're talking with him about a number of issues, including his book and the recent sale of Current TV to Al Jazeera for reportedly earned $100 million. You gave a lot of your Nobel Prize money to climate change and the fight for climate.
I gave all of it.
Yeah.
I gave all of it.
And I remember when they were people like Bill O'Reilly were hitting you about paltry amounts of money that you supposedly gave in your 1997 tax returns, like 0.2% or something like that. You've been fighting against that? Has that kind of been a stigma?
No, I don't. I haven't heard about that since 1997, to tell you the truth. No, I donate generously and am one of the largest contributors every year to the Climate Reality Project, which is focused on solutions to the climate crisis.
Let's talk just for a moment before we get to our listeners about fracking. What do you think about the anticipated expansion here in California, leasing of Monterey Shale and all that?
I'm concerned about it. It has pluses and minuses. Advocates have long pointed out that natural gas has only 50% of the CO2 content when it's burned compared to coal. A lot of it leaks in the fracking process. And when the methane leaks directly into the atmosphere, each molecule has 70 times the potential warming effect compared to CO2 over a 10-20 year period, and then it lessens somewhat. But that means that not very much has to leak to wipe out the advantage. And then there are the water requirements, 6 million gallons on average for each new fracking well. And the water that's used is mixed with very toxic chemicals, and that sometimes pollutes the groundwater. The industry claims it doesn't, but there are too many examples showing that it does. Often when they re-inject the poisoned fracking water back deep into the earth, these and other issues are ones that I think are deserving of much more careful exploration. And one final point, Michael. People often say fracking is an issue that requires the classic question, is the glass half full or half empty? The atmosphere is completely full, and we're going to have to make a shift to renewable energy sources. That we have the ability to do that. The report came out just yesterday that last year the largest new additions to electricity production in the U.S. came from wind, 42% of all new energy production from wind. In Australia, wind energy, in the report that came from there last week, is now cheaper than electricity from a new coal plant or a new gas plant. Solar photovoltaic energy is spreading far more rapidly than anyone thought was possible. In 2010, the world's cumulative investments in renewable energy for the first time exceeded the world's investments in fossil fuel energy.
Hallelujah.
Yes, it's good news. Now, the fracking wave of the last 2 years has put them out in front again, but it is inexorable that we will shift to renewable energy. It's coming down in cost very rapidly. But part of the problem with speeding up this transition is that we provide massive subsidies to coal and oil. And on a global basis, it amounts to about $500 billion a year. We ought to save money by stopping those subsidies to the dirty carbon fuels.
You also point out in your book that oil, gas, and coal companies virtually support all the news and political commentary that one sees on television. And, you know, I'm struck by your optimism because you start out early on in the book talking about Jules Verne, and then you get to Huxley and Orwell and, you know, some of the dystopian writers. And one thinks that, again, peril and opportunity going in that fraternal twin way that you write about. We should mention, by the way, that we'll get to callers here, that you walk the walk. I mean, you got solar panels in your house. You've gone completely solar and for the most part, even solar panel houseboat I was reading and geothermal wells and driving an electric car now.
I do.
let's hear from our listeners.
Okay.
We'll begin, Frederick, with you. Good morning.
Well, it's with great honor, good morning, gentlemen, that I ask you, Mr. Gore, about the – let's contrast the conservative movement toward what I would say privatization since the Goldwater era. And they have been focused on less government, less taxation, and less regulation. On purpose, they've wanted to starve the beast. Now, Mr. Gore, you're speaking, on the other hand, of a social capitalism or a social democracy. What I'm pointing to is that we on the left do not have a clear and concise frame, do we, a way to speak about the valuable role that the government plays, but yet the conservatives have been so articulate and so inundating with their message to privatize. And yet we don't know that ultimately that's what conservatives are up to, is privatization.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. Thank you for making it. I was encouraged this week to see a new poll showing that young people have reversed the long trend toward public opinion being in favor of smaller government. Now, for the first time, the pendulum is beginning to swing back. We need to reform the way government operates. We need to make sure that it performs highly. But there are so many things that the private sector is not going to be able to do. Cleaning up the environment is only one of a great many examples.
Or maybe the privatization of water down the line, as some are sort of recoiling at the horror prospect of it.
Yeah,
you're talking about water sustainability. So
yeah, but even there, a government has a role to play. I mean, you can make a sound intellectual case for putting a price on water in water short regions where the waste will be discouraged when it has a price. For similar reasons, I've always argued that we should have a tax on CO2. And then reduce other taxes to make up for it. And now, of course, with the growing long-term deficit issue, people are looking at the potential for a CO2 tax with a somewhat different attitude. The resistance is still very strong, of course. But coming back to this questioner's point, I couldn't agree more. We have to reclaim our ability as Americans to work together and, when necessary, to work together through the instruments of self-government.
There's a listener, John from Oakland, says, what does Mr. Gore think about Loris Lessing's assertion that the United States Congress is corrupt and needs to be reformed and that this may be the pivot point for addressing all the issues Mr. Gore is concerned with? And I'd add to that, because you point out in your book, a lot of statistics in this book to grapple with. 50% of the senators, you forgive my use of this word, are in a pipeline that they wind up as lobbyists.
Yeah.
In the House of Representatives is about 40%.
Yeah. And that used to be a rarity. And now you'll see some of them go into elective politics with a business plan that has them planning in advance.
We've been talking for years about getting money out of politics. Yeah. And, you know, it seems like almost for many an impossible task to change the infrastructure, to change the whole system, which is essentially almost a system of bribery.
Yeah, I strongly agree with Larry Lessig's work, and he and I are friends and allies, particularly where this issue is concerned. I think he's a terrific and brilliant guy. I have, throughout my political career, back when I was in politics, always called for 100% public funding of all federal elections. Both times I ran for president, it was part of my platform. Often the Republicans would not even attack me on that issue because they couldn't get people to believe that I was actually in favor of it. But I am and have been. It's a difficult political sell. But here are some other things that we can do. We can pass the pending Disclose Act to make sure that these anonymous contributions are ruled illegal. That's just a minimum requirement, I think. I think we ought to overturn the Citizens United decision that describes corporations as persons. I talk about the history of that line of legal reasoning in the book. And of course, a constitutional amendment is difficult if that's what's required. But it's important, and an alternative strategy would be for those who believe in these values to help win several presidential elections in a row and change the Supreme Court so that a new court can overturn Citizens United. Now, finally, I do think, and I make this argument in the book, that over time, the rise of the internet will inexorably diminish the role of money in politics, which is driven today in significant measure by the need on the part of politicians to amass these huge war chests, primarily for buying 30-second television advertisements. And as the internet becomes more prominent and eventually the central way in which we communicate, it does bring the promise of re-empowering individuals to play their role as citizens and to revitalize representative democracy.
Our guest is former Vice President Al Gore, Nobel recipient, and also an Oscar winner for Inconvenient Truth. His new book is The Future, Six Drivers of Global Change. And we should mention that he will be tonight at the Herbst Theater in San Francisco talking on stage with Barbara Kingsolver at City Arts and Lectures as part of their series at 7:30. And I'll go to another caller. And Janet, that's you. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Gore. Thank you so much for all your work and your courage in standing up and stating the emperor has no clothes.
Thank you.
I wanted to just basically make a comment and so just give you my sense of frustration that the kind of lovely film that you put out and others like it, they don't seem to be on the mainstream stage. And when I speak with friends and family members and tell them, you know, about these movies and that they really need to be paying attention, they don't seem to really want to hear about it. And it's just frustrating. And I just wonder, you know, I guess I'm just making a comment about that.
Yeah, thank you. And it is frustrating for sure. And the mainstream stage that you talk about is financed by special interests and business lobbies. And when they run these ads on so-called clean coal, they're not trying to encourage you to go down to the store and buy some coal. They're trying to encourage you to adopt the political points of view that they know are conducive to their business and their profits. And where the national conversation is concerned, I talked earlier here about the dismal failure of journalists during the debates. Here's an analogy. In a family with a loud alcoholic father who flies into a rage every time alcohol or his abuse of it is mentioned, the family learns to keep quiet and keep the peace by never talking about the subject that is forbidden. And a lot of the climate deniers, many of them receiving funding from the carbon polluters, fly into a fury at the very mention of the word climate. And many in the mainstream media have become intimidated into not even mentioning the word, much less pointing out that it's threatening the future of our civilization. Now, that can change when people like this caller and others who do care make it clear to the politicians and to the news media that we have got to address this challenge and the others that I mentioned in this book.
I also want to mention, lest I forget, that City Arts this evening is sold out, so it's not possible to get a ticket to the event that features our guest Al Gore with novelist Barbara Kingsolver. I want to read a couple of emails here about the Qatar deal with Current and also a couple about climate change. Just for comments with the latter, Christine writes on our website, "I'd like to thank Mr. Gore for his courage in facilitating the return of journalism to the USA. If critics of this decision don't have the foresight to see that a country like Qatar has more than oil to offer the world, then maybe a few hours watching Al Jazeera America will help open their eyes." And another listener, Merrily, writes, "I'm delighted that Current TV sold to Al Jazeera. I have gone to the Al Jazeera network a number of times on the internet to get more information about some issues that we in America normally get. In response to the statement I heard about a year ago, America, specifically the USA, is the most entertained, least informed public in the developed world. This move should help to swing the balance back toward more informed. However, it must be available on the cable systems, not just the internet."
Yeah.
And yeah. A couple of questions about climate change. I'll link these together because they are sort of related. This is a woman named Anne Marie who says, "Thank you to Al Gore from this Tennessee native for your tireless work to engage the public on climate change. I'm a professor in communication studies at San Jose State University where I focus on interdisciplinary climate change education. Mm. What advice do you have for teachers developing climate change curriculum and co-curriculum for all ages?" And related to this, Carol asks on our Facebook page, "Mr. Gore, and I so wish that I could say former President Gore, what is your rock-bottom minimum formula for what specifically is mandatory to accomplish regarding time and frame and other parameters to keep global climate change from totally devastating our planet? We need your help for a long time. So one asks about curriculum, the other asks about what advice you have, and they're kind of linked, really, aren't they?
Yeah, they are linked. As John Muir once said, you pick one thing out and you find it's hitched to the entire universe. These questions are linked, and I would love to learn more from this professor of communications on climate myself. And I'm not sure that my advice on developing the curriculum is worth what the time spent on it. But
I have adopted Inconvenient Truth. I
put out a children's version of an Inconvenient Truth in the book version. I also put out an app on the iTunes store called Our Choice that allows an interactive exploration of all the solutions to the climate crisis. And I do, of course, recommend that. All of the proceeds go to the Climate Reality Project, which is also focused on communicating about the climate crisis and the solutions to the climate crisis. Now, the second question.
Looking for solutions, actually. She's looking for ways
to save. Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, we need to put a price on carbon. We have two great tools for shaping our future. One is democracy. One is capitalism. We need to reclaim the integrity and proper functioning of each. And where democracy is concerned, if I could deal with that one first, we need to win the conversation. And let me just say what I mean by that. I remember as a young boy spending my summers growing up in Tennessee that when the conversation on civil rights was won, a friend of mine made some semi-racist comment, and another friend spoke up immediately and said, "Hey, man, we don't put up with that anymore." And in millions of places, that turn took place, and we won the conversation on civil rights. We still have a ways to go, but it was dramatic. Second example, just last week, there was an inspiring story about two gay guys holding hands, waiting in line to buy pizza, and some homophobe made a hateful comment, and literally everyone else in the line turned on the homophobe and said, "Cut it out. We don't put up with that." We're winning that conversation. Now, the conversation on the climate crisis is one that we have to win in similar ways. Now, where capitalism is concerned, the pollution that causes global warming is currently labeled an externality, meaning we can just forget about it and ignore it on corporate profit loss statements, in national economic plans and reports. By putting a price on it, either directly with a CO2 tax or indirectly with a cap and trade system, we then internalize it into all of the economic decisions that we make, and we start being able to use the market as an ally in solving global warming.
This all comes down to the imperative of not being dependent on fossil fuels, though.
It does. There are other things that also need to be addressed, factory farming and
overall carbon impact.
Agriculture. Yeah. Yes, there are a number of things, but the most important by far is the dependence on fossil fuels. Earth, Inc. now uses fossil carbon-based energy for 85% of the energy used in the world. And that is what results in this devastating spewing of global warming pollution into the atmosphere, again, as if it's an open sewer.
But here's something I have found insoluble through the years in this whole discussion, this whole conversation, which, as you say, is vital to our planetary survival. And that is, the developing countries will talk about the United States and its consumption of fossil fuels and its use of its carbon imprint and so forth, carbon footprint. And they will say, "We didn't have our opportunity. We're rising now. This should be equitable. The United States has dominated and, you know, has spewed forth all this into the atmosphere. Why can't we get some equality here? We shouldn't be, in other words, forced not to be equitable." There's equitability as a big question, isn't it?
Yes, of course. And their aspirations cannot be denied. But they should have the option of pursuing those aspirations in ways that don't replicate mistakes that have been made in the industrial world. They're not clamoring, for example, to build telephone poles with lines everywhere. They're leapfrogging to mobile phones and smartphones. And now the overall investments in renewable energy are more in the developed and emerging economies than in the industrial economies. We're now seeing a dramatic push for solar and wind in these developing countries. They have seen for themselves the horrors that can accompany these pollution levels. Look at China right now. In Beijing,
you need a gas mask to walk in Beijing almost.
You literally need a gas mask on some days. And there's an app for that. You can look at Chinese air quality in the App Store. And it started with the U.S. Embassy, by the way, putting up these air quality monitors that gave the truth in contrast to what the Chinese government was showing. And now there are mass demonstrations in China against the growing levels of conventional air pollution. And there is growing concern about the impact of global warming with the bigger floods, the deeper droughts, the stronger storms. There was a demonstration yesterday in this country outside the White House by survivors of Superstorm Sandy demanding action on the climate crisis. You know, you mentioned my movie generously earlier, An Inconvenient Truth. Perhaps the single most common criticism from deniers about that movie was when they pointed to the image that I showed in animation of ocean water rising and flooding into the World Trade Center Memorial Site. They said, that's ridiculous. It's demagogic. Well, it happened last October. And Governor Andrew Cuomo of New York gave a speech in which he said he was down at that center site in the dark of that night when the ocean came into Manhattan. And he said, I was thinking about Al Gore's movie and that scene because I was watching it happen right before my eyes. People are connecting the dots now. They realize our future is at stake. Now, we as human beings are hardwired to respond automatically to the kinds of threats our ancestors survived, snakes, other humans with weapons. But we also have the capacity to use our higher reasoning functions to perceive even more serious threats to our future that have to be reasoned out and dealt with by communicating with one another. It's not an automatic response. It's an act of will. It comes when we connect our heads and our hearts and think about our children and grandchildren and understand that that actions in the present have consequences in the future. That's what this book is all about.
I think we're on point here with the next caller. Let's bring you on here. Rob, welcome.
Hi, Mr. Vice President. Yes, global climate change is real. It's caused by human activity since the industrial age. And I'm not a climate denier. However, it's absolutely false to say that we can reverse global climate change. That's, you know, there are scientists like Bjorn Lomborg, the Scandinavian, the skeptical environmentalist, who says you can't dump trillions of dollars with carbon offsets and boondoggles like that because you're going to slow down the global economy. You're right. Michael's right that we can't stop China and India from industrializing. And China is building coal factories, coal power plants every week still. So that's the problem. We've got it. It's there. We have to adjust to it. We need seawalls along Long Island. That's true. We need to adjust to it. What do you say to that?
Well, I appreciate you not being a denier, but with all due respect, despair is often the last refuge of denial. And many people go straight from denial to despair without pausing on the intermediate step of actually solving the problem. And now many offer adaptation as a substitute for actually solving the problem. Here's why that's wrong in my view. First of all, we do have a moral obligation and a necessity to adapt to the changes that are already taking place. And the caller is quite correct up to a point in saying that some of the changes now triggered will continue no matter what we do. But here's the key. Unless we stop spewing all of this heat-trapping pollution into the atmosphere every day, ultimately, we will not be able to adapt to it. We have to do both adaptation and mitigation and solutions simultaneously because we simply cannot allow the extreme consequences that would occur if we don't take action. They carry with them the potential for ending human civilization as we know it.
Well, in fact, you talk about global collective decision-making in this book.
Yes, yes.
And you see that as a real likelihood or necessity.
Yes, it is, and it has to start with people expressing moral values. And for those who are skeptical that such a mechanism can work, look at the anti-apartheid movement. Look at the abolition movement, both of these in the pre-internet days, where now we have even more power to do it. Look at the successive waves of democracy spreading around the world. Look at the anti-colonialism movement in the 1960s that spread from country to country. I mentioned gay rights earlier. The focus has been on the U.S., but the British Parliament last week passed approved gay marriage overwhelmingly, and in countries around the world, we're seeing an understanding and acceptance of that moral imperative. When we connect the dots and understand what is right and what is essential to safeguard our future and protect human values, then people see it at the same time in countries all over the world. And by using the internet and networked communication and social media, we can build a movement that counterbalances the rear guard action of these carbon polluters and their ideological allies who want to suffocate the possibilities of government action in any realm that threatens corporations with regulations or taxes. And we can assert the human values and prevail.
Well, it's inspiring to hear you speak with your usual passion. I always think of contingencies that can't be predicted, and they're in the book, too. I mean, in the sense that only up to a certain extent can we control our future, but we can indeed and must do, I think, what you outlined here very well. And I thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, well, thank you for the interview and the callers. Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
What's next for Al Gore? Seconds left?
I'm going to Santa Clara for
In terms of your metamorphosis.
I will spend most of my time, as I do now, as chair of the Climate Reality Project. I train thousands of people around the world. I give slideshows. I write articles, and I try to mobilize solutions to the climate crisis.
An educator and a proselytizer, in addition to being an entrepreneur and a Nobel recipient. Thank you so much for being with
us. Thank you, Michael.
Al Gore, his book, The Future, Six Drivers of Global Change. For all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.